We sprinkle it on our food without giving it a second thought. Salt is a cheap commodity that most modern Americans take for granted. Yet this mineral was long one of the world's most valuable commodities. It helped establish trade routes, roads, and cities. It helped secure empires and provoke revolutions. It was used as money, and governments sought to monopolize its production. With me to discuss these subjects and more is Mark Kurlansky, the author of Salt, A World History. Mr. Kurlansky, welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
You write that salt has 14,000 uses. Historically, what have been among the most important of them?
Well, historically, the most important has been the fact that salt has this ability to withdraw moisture and kill bacteria and therefore preserve food. And this is really one of the fundamental things that gave salt its historic importance because, for one thing, northern countries didn't have forage for animals during the winter, so all animals were slaughtered in usually October. All crops were harvested. And from October or November through to April or May, the only food you had was food that had been preserved in salt. But even more important than that is the fact that you couldn't trade in fresh food because transportation was too slow and there wasn't refrigeration. So, for example, if you were a dairy farmer and you produced cream and butter, you could sell it to your neighbors, and that was about it. But you could preserve it in salt and turn it into a cheese and throw that cheese on a wagon and sell it all over the world. The same was true for fish and meat and vegetables. Salted vegetables were a very important commodity of commerce. And these food items were among the most important import-export products, and they were the basis of most economies. So it's not an exaggeration to say that if you didn't have salt, you didn't have an international economy.
How valuable has it been? Could we say, for example, that salt has been worth its weight in gold?
Salt being worth its weight in gold is actually a misinterpretation of a West African way of doing business. When salt was traded across the Sahara to places like Timbuktu, the salt seller and the buyer would sit down with a pile of salt and a pile of gold, and the seller would offer a pile of gold, and the buyer and the seller would offer a pile of salt, and one would walk away and the other would add to his pile until they decided they were of equal worth. But at no time in history was the pile of gold heavier than the pile of salt.
We sometimes worry these days about America's dependence on foreign oil. Interestingly, in your book, we find that English rulers, including Queen Elizabeth I, long worried about a dangerous dependence on foreign salt. What was their concern?
Yeah, she used just about those words, dangerous dependence on foreign sea salt. This was at a time when fisheries were of tremendous value. Fisheries were producing salted fish, mainly cod, also herring. Herring and cod were the two most valuable commodities. And not only was this a huge part of the economy of northern nations, but it was also strategic in the sense that armies and navies were fed on it. And to cure fish, you needed sea salt, not because of some poetic thing about the fish coming from the sea and the salt coming from the sea, but the way that sea salt was made, which was natural solar evaporation, produced a kind of large crystal that was ideally suited for the best results in curing fish. And England produced very, very little sea salt because it didn't have the right climate for solar evaporation. Not enough sun, and it rained too often. And the closest place to get sea salt, the most northern sea salt works in Europe, was on the French coast in Brittany. France was a chronic historic enemy. So they were in a very dangerous situation, depending on their enemy for this strategic commodity. You might make the same argument today about Saudi oil. But of course, we now look back on the salt and we think, isn't that silly? And a few hundred years from now, you know, the same may happen. Some writer who's slightly off may write a book on the history of oil, and everybody will say, oil? Why oil? I said, well, you know, this was considered really vital, and there were wars fought over it. And people would think, that's just incredibly mad.
One of the points I took from your book was the central idea that valuable commodities can be defined differently over time, that the value is not fixed by any means. And
yes, I mean, that is one of the central ideas that motivated me to write the book, this idea of what is value, what makes something value, and the fact that it's a transitory thing. What is at one time valuable can very rapidly lose its value.
There's another strategic example of salt in wartime. You mentioned the American Civil War, in which the South not only had disadvantages, a smaller population, a smaller arms industry than the North, but you suggest that it had another strategic disadvantage. It didn't make enough salt compared to the North.
Yes. This, by the way, was true in a lot of other wars also. You have to remember that without salt, marching armies didn't have provisions. They had to live off of the land. And also, all mammals, not only human beings, need salt. So the military couldn't have horses, they couldn't have livestock unless they had salt. And furthermore, salt was the only thing to cauterize wounds. So an army that didn't have salt was in a lot of trouble. So for many centuries, it was a strategic concept to, if possible, cut off your enemy from their salt supply. And the Union did this very well with the Confederacy, because the Confederacy did not produce a lot of salt. The British, what's called Liverpool salt, which was produced in nearby Cheshire, and this was the ballast on ships, on British ships that went to New Orleans. And they offloaded the salt and they unloaded cotton. And so much salt was coming in from the cotton trade that they didn't need to produce much. And one of the first things that the Union did when the Civil War broke out is they imposed a naval blockade on the entire South, which meant no more Liverpool salt. And then, in addition to that, the Union Army had a policy of seeking out and destroying Southern salt works. This was kind of an ongoing game because there's not really a lot to a salt work, you know, and even if you destroy it, it doesn't take a lot to rebuild it. And there was this forgotten campaign that went on during the entire Civil War on the Gulf Coast of Florida, where there were sea salt works, and the Union Navy would go in and destroy them, and the Southerners would rebuild them, and the Navy would go in and destroy them again. This went on for the entire war.
I'd like to move backwards a little bit in the history of the Americas. You make the observation that salt often determined the location of roads and towns.
Especially in North America, or at least we know about it in North America. Actually, we know about it in the case of Romans also. But in North America, the original roads were made by animals looking for salt. And they would find a salt lick, or they would make their way to a marsh or to the coast. And this would leave a trail that then people would follow and enlarge on, and eventually would turn it into a road. And of course, at the end of this road was always a salt work. And it was always thought to be a good place to build a town by a source of salt. So it was a natural road network from town to town. Only the roads came first and the towns came afterwards.
You quote an earlier writer who claimed that there's a direct correlation between salt taxes and despotism. Is there?
Well, you can make a case for it. The fact is that salt taxes are extremely unpopular. So in a democratic society, you probably won't have them because people won't let you have them. The problem with salt tax is that, in effect, it's a poll tax, because everybody, rich and poor, use salt about the same amount. And so it's a tax that the rich don't pay any more on than the poor. So everybody but the rich hates it. And this was a very hot political issue everywhere where governments tried to tax salt. In China, where they just completely controlled the salt and artificially kept the prices high, there is a long history of centuries and centuries of uprisings over it. It was one of the major issues leading to the French Revolution, and it was the issue Gandhi used to kick off the Indian independence movement.
Why are governments so concerned about doing as the Chinese did, grabbing a monopoly of the salt business in the first place?
Well, salt is a very appealing thing for governments to try to control because everybody has to have it. So it's not going to go out of fashion, and it's not going to be regionalized, and it's a universal commodity. So it's an easy thing to tax.
The search for salt seems to take us into a new era. It takes us into that era you alluded to briefly a while ago, the era of petroleum. The search for salt has helped humans both find oil and extract it.
Yeah, geology, which was a fairly late developing science, used to be very much focused on the question of salt, just like today is very much focused on oil and, you know, other fossil fuels. The questions that geologists pondered is, what is salt, how is it created, and where are you likely to find it? And a lot of geologists became fascinated by a structure known as the salt dome, which is a natural phenomena where there is this column of very pure salt, sodium chloride, that goes miles into the earth and pushes out in the surface in a shape like a small knoll or hill, which is why it's called a salt dome. Of course, there's, you know, grass and trees or whatever the landscape is on top of it, so it's not easily recognizable. But if you find a salt dome, it's a great source of salt. Avery Island in Louisiana, which is today owned by one family that produces Tabasco sauce, is a salt dome. And I've been into the mine, and it's just amazing. I mean, the miles and miles of the stuff that looks like ice, it's that pure, just solid salt crystal. But what they started finding was that when you take salt from salt domes, it goes all right for a while, but then it starts getting all black and mucky, and it's hard to clean. And a few people, interestingly, not geologists, sort of entrepreneur types, started saying, hey, this black muck is oil, and drilling salt domes. The first oil well in the United States was drilled in Pennsylvania on the site of a salt dome, and produced oil, but not enough for anybody to get terribly excited about. But then some years later, they started drilling domes. Also, explorers, against the advice of geologists, started drilling salt domes in East Texas and found the East Texas oil field, which is maybe the largest oil strike ever found, and began the age of petroleum. And then people started going all over the world, going back to salt domes. You know, they went to the Middle East where Herodotus had written about salt, and they drilled and they found oil. And there was this great excitement about drilling salt. And, of course, sometimes it just produced salt. But often enough, it produced oil. And one of the offshoots of this sudden development of the age of petroleum was that engineers started getting serious about drilling techniques. You know, at the time of the first wells, we did not have a level of drilling technology equal to the medieval Chinese in the Western world. But within 10 or 15 years, they developed rotary drills and all these things. And for the first time in history, we started getting an idea of what was under the surface of the earth. And it turned out there's lots of salt. It's everywhere, huge, huge beds. I mean, the entire Great Lakes area going, you know, way up into Ontario and, you know, west to Minnesota and east to all of upstate New York is one continuous salt bed under the city of Detroit, and all of these individual salt mines that we knew about and exploited, it turned out they were all connected. It was just one solid sheet of this stuff. There's a bed of salt that goes from Alsace in eastern France through Germany and Austria and southern Poland. There's salt everywhere. And that ruined the price of salt. It's turned around its value.
So long after the oil is gone, the salt will still be there.
Yes, I think so.
Well, Mr. Kurlansky, thank you so much for visiting with us.
It's my pleasure.
I've been visiting with Mark Kurlansky, the author of Salt, A World History.